are in Boston at the Park Plaza Hotel. This is the 33rd annual Cognitive Science Conference. And with me is Michael Tomasello, who is the winner of the Heineken Prize for Cognitive Science at this meeting. But more importantly, I suppose you are co-director of the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology in Leipzig. Now, the last time I saw you, however, was a long time ago in Emory, right?
Right.
What's the title of your talk is Cooperation and Human Cognition. Could you tell me a little bit about what you've been working on? Because the last time I saw you, when we did that series, The Human Quest, we were looking at ways children worked. You were doing a lot of work with kids. So you've since moved on to a lot of work with other primates as well, as far as I can see. So
yes.
Could you just bring me up to speed?
Yeah. So I've been in search of what makes human cognition unique, what makes human ability to think and understand the world unique. And I've become convinced that it's not because individuals have evolved to become individually smarter, but because they've evolved to put their heads together with others, to, in the first instance, to collaborate. So let's say something like collaborative foraging or collaborative hunting, where we put our heads together and we have a common goal and we each have our own role and we strategize and communicate and so forth. But then, in addition, all the way up to today, we have social institutions. Language is an institution of sorts with conventions that we ourselves don't invent, that we inherit, and we're part of a community, and people actively teach it to us. So the idea is that we are adapted for tuning into other people, collaborating with them, learning from them, communicating with them, and that without that, human cognition would not be so very different from that of other apes. So to take a concrete example, a child raised on a desert island outside of any social interaction whatsoever, my hypothesis would be their cognition would be very similar to that of other apes. But growing up in a culture with a language and with people teaching things and showing things and collaborate, etc., it changes the whole nature of the way we understand the world.
So this would be the theme of that of your book on why we cooperate.
Yeah.
What do you do? What do you say to people who say, "Well, but we also do an awful lot of conflict"?
Absolutely. We are primates, and primates compete with one another. And I think there are a lot of other species that are reasonably highly cooperative. But what we have come from a lineage of primates who are highly intelligent because of competition. So the so-called Machiavellian intelligence, that they're trying to outwit their competitors. Some of our research with the great apes shows that they are able to understand when others see things and don't see things. So if the dominant individual sees this piece of food, I can't go for it. But if it's behind a rock and he doesn't see it, I can go for it. I understand what his goal is, what he's trying to do. And so the non-human primates, especially the great apes, already have a lot of sophisticated cognitive skills, causal understanding, tool use, and human cooperation evolved with already this highly sophisticated cognition evolved for competition. So our cooperation kind of lays on top of it, as it were, and that's in many ways the human dilemma that novelists write about all the time, is our individual selfish interests and what's right for our interactions with other people and for the good of the group.
So what animals do you work with now?
Great apes.
In Leipzig?
In Leipzig, we have a facility, the Wolfgang Kurler Primate Research Center, and we're the only research facility in the world that has all four great ape species, chimpanzees, orangutans, gorillas, and bonobos.
Are you still doing any work with children?
Yes, and we do research with children as well, and so that's mostly what we do, is compare the two of them. So in some of our recent studies, we've shown that children collaborate in different ways in very simple tasks. So 2 and 3 year old children already collaborate in ways that are very different from the way apes do. When the partner needs help, the child stops what they're doing and helps their partner toward their common goal. With chimps, if the partner's struggling, he just waits. With children, if the partner doesn't get his reward because of some accident that we experimentalists set up, they help make sure that he gets his reward out of the collaboration, and the The chimps don't do that in anything like the same way. Children can reverse roles in collaboration. If they've been in a collaboration, they learn about the other role, the one that they're not playing, such that they now can do that role without any further learning. And the chimps don't seem to pick up the same thing from the other role. So if people don't cooperate, children will chastise them from 3 years old. They'll say they'll get on people's case and say, no, you're not supposed to do it like that. You're supposed to do it like this. And chimps don't do this third party punishment, as it's called. So we have been trying to document many different domains, many different behaviors where children seem to be adapted for collaboration in a way that other apes are not.
These two papers that are three-year-old children intervene in third-party moral transgressions.
Yes.
Another one, young children share the spoils after collaboration.
Yes.
Could you?
So the young children sharing the spoils after collaboration, our newest study along those lines is that young children about 3 years of age have always been thought to be a little bit on the selfish side. So if you give them some candies and tell them to divide them with another child, they keep the vast majority for themselves. But if you put them in a collaborative context where they work together to produce those candies, and one child ends up with them, again, by accident, because that's the way we set up an experiment, they divide them equally. So if they've worked together to produce them, it induces them to think about equal sharing. And we have control conditions where they walk into the room and they find them one on one side and all the candy on one side and none on the other, and then they don't tend to share. And we even have another control condition where they work separately and one of them gets more than the other, but they each produce their own reward and then they don't share that often. So collaboration induces the sort of idea of equal sharing. So that's one of them. And the other study that you mentioned, the third-party intervention, we have young children about 3 years old. Now, it's well known that young children follow norms. They follow moral norms and conventional norms. They want to know, how should I do this, and they follow the rules. But what we've started looking at recently is they don't just follow the rules, they enforce the rules. And so it's not so easy to figure out why they enforce rules. They follow rules because if you don't follow rules, number one, you might get punished. Number two, you just don't fit in and people might not like you. There are all kinds of reasons to follow the rules. But why enforce them? And I'm not even sure we have a great answer for that, except that somehow you're standing up for the group. This is the way we do it. This is the way it's done. If you're not following the rules, then it's in my interest that everybody else cooperate if I'm going to cooperate.
A couple of others here, then I just want to read them out, and then I'm going to ask you a question. But social engagement leads two-year-olds to overestimate others' knowledge. And 18 months old show false belief, understanding, and inactive helping paradigm. So, is this theory of other minds is still a valid concept?
Yes,
of course.
Yes.
But at one point, it was thought that didn't actually kick in till about four.
That's
so
correct.
These ages have been going down and down.
Down and down.
Could you tell me that little story?
So the classic false belief task is that the child watches while someone else sees something hidden, and then when that person leaves the room, the thing is moved. And an adult would say, oh, well, when he comes back in, he doesn't know it's been moved. He was gone. So he'll look where he saw it being hidden. And he doesn't know it's in this new place. And children, up to about age four, it's quite remarkable. If you ask them explicitly, they'll say, oh, he'll look where it really is, even though he has no way of knowing that it moved, because they have a reality bias. It's called the pull of the real. But it turns out if you use other methods, you can get children making this same determination at a younger age. And we have used one particular method, which is a kind of a helping paradigm, where an experimenter puts an object in a bucket, he leaves the room, somebody moves it, and then he comes back in and he tries to get in the bucket. And he says, right? And if the child just wants to help him open the bucket, he comes over to the bucket. But many children go fetch the toy for him because they know that he wants what's in the bucket, or he wants what he thinks is in the bucket. And he's just wrong. It's not in the bucket anymore. So these 18-month-olds toddle over and get him the thing. And if, by the way, he doesn't leave the room, he stays in the room the whole time, they come over and try to help him open the bucket rather than go fetch the toy. So they know in the context, they're trying to figure out what does he want, what's his goal. And in one context, they say he wants to open the bucket because he knows the thing is in there. And then the other one, because he doesn't know it's been moved, he probably wants what used to be in there.
Now, are there not other species, other primates, where you actually get this helping routine going on?
We have seen chimpanzees helping. We have studies documenting chimpanzees helping. It's at a certain level. And the studies that we've done in collaboration, what we find is that children help more when they're in the middle of a collaboration than they just do in a normal circumstance. And with the chimps, their level is the same, whether they're in a helping situation or not. So we actually think this is one of the keys to the evolution of human cooperation, is that when you're interdependent, if I can't go hunting by myself and be successful, I need you, then we're going together and you're having trouble, well, of course, I have to stop and help you because we're on a collaborative enterprise here and I need you. And this interdependence sort of changes everything. And again, we found traces of this in young children where they help more in the middle of a collaborative enterprise than otherwise, and chimpanzees not the same pattern.
Again, 12-month-olds communicate helpfully and appropriately for knowledgeable and ignorant partners.
Well, this is one of the most surprising results that we've produced in our laboratory, to my mind, is prelinguistic children, 12 months old, they're pointing, and they start pointing at around 12 months old. This is really, most of them have not been pointing for very long at all at 12 months. And what we have is an individual who has seen a toy fall on one side of the table, and another toy has fallen on the other side of the table while he wasn't looking. So the two toys have behaved identically, but he saw one of them falling and he didn't see the other one falling. And then he looks at his table and he goes, you know, like, where's my toy? It's ambiguous because there were two toys, and they point to the one that he didn't see falling from the table. So they point to the one he's ignorant about, to the one whose location he's ignorant about, and they don't point to the one that he saw falling. So they are taking into account the ignorant, what he is ignorant of when he says, where's my toy, and using that to inform them helpfully. It's a form of helping when I inform you of something that you want to know but don't know, and so they're helping him by informing him. And we've tried chimpanzees in several versions, and they don't inform helpfully.
This chimpanzees are rational maximizers in an ultimatum game.
Yeah.
But just remind people what the ultimatum game is.
Well, in the ultimatum game, there's a division, there's some reward, and I'm supposed to divide it between you and me, but you get the possibility of rejecting the division if you don't like it. So I could offer you one and I keep nine, but what most people do in your position is reject that and say, hey, that's not fair, I don't want the one. And in a sense, it's not rational because you are rejecting one that you could have. What does it matter that I have nine? But that's the way people behave. And in fact, they reject splits up to, like, if I give you three and I keep seven, people still have a tendency to reject that. Chimpanzees, on the other hand, and the proposal would be, because they don't have the same sense of fairness, they don't get offended about the way I split it up. They don't say, hey, you're not being fair. So when they're in a similar situation, we ran a study with them, and they take anything. If you offer them one, they take it. If you offer them three, they take it. It doesn't matter. And you can say that's more rational in the sense of the way the economists talk about rational in terms of maximizing their rewards, because they're getting one or three, where the human in their position is rejecting that. So they're actually doing better than the human because they're not worried about a sense of fairness. So they maximize.
So this is what you've been talking about. You've called the cultural intelligence hypothesis,
yes.
Right? Do you want to state that?
So we did a very large study, over 100 chimpanzees, over 100 children, and we gave them a very large test battery with lots of different cognitive tasks in it. and 2.5-year-old children. So 2.5-year-old children, they've been using language for a year or so, but they haven't gone to school yet. They're certainly not reading. They're not doing any number things or quantities. So 2.5-year-old children have started in culture, but they're really just getting started. What we found was that in tasks relying on cognition of the physical world, so tool use, understanding quantities, causality, quantities, the children and the chimpanzees were identical. They were very, very similar in their skills. But in the social domain, so these were things like reading the intentions of others, understanding communication from others, and social learning, the 2.5-year-old children were already double in the way that we measured it, what the chimps were. So this is the idea that we have a special cultural, special social or cultural intelligence that enables us to now learn from others, communicate with others, collaborate with others, and this will kind of bootstrap our understanding of quantities and causality and stuff in the physical world. So think about mathematics. If you were a child on a desert island from birth, what would you invent of mathematics yourself? Probably very little. The most of the math that you know and that I know comes because people taught us things. We have Arabic numerals, which make it easier, and people taught us how to manipulate them. And we have number words that help us in counting and whatnot. And so as children are using this cultural intelligence to acquire the skills and knowledge and symbols and artifacts of their culture, then that is bootstrapping their cognition across the board. But we caught them at an age, at 2.5, where their cognitive skills in the physical domain, in the physical world, were still the same as chimps. They still had the general great ape issue physical cognition, but the social cognition was already ahead, and the proposal is that then that will bootstrap everything else.
How much do you lean on neuroscience in your work, in the sense that do you have some model of the human neurocognitive architecture? Do you have a model of the mind? There's a lot of people here. There's a whole spectrum of people going from general purpose computational devices to massively modular minds and so on.
I'm sorry to say I haven't worked in the neuroscience domain very much, but there is, as you know, a quite active area of investigation called social neuroscience, which is looking at things like understanding of false beliefs and joint attention and some of the things that I've studied as well. I know I've learned things by talking to people, but I have not really investigated it myself, and I don't really have specific hypotheses. And in the case of comparing with chimpanzees, we don't do any of that kind of imaging work with chimpanzees for ethical reasons, and no one does, basically. So it's going to be hard to ever with the current methodologies anyway, to know much about how the chimp brain and human brain compare when engaged in active cognitive processing.
Do you recall, if you think back about this trajectory of yours, I mean, was there some original stimulus that sent you off into science in the first place? Was it a teacher or a...
Basically I was at the university in the 60s, at Duke University, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do, but I took a class in basically evolutionary psychology, biological psychology, and I saw this guy up there talking about all this incredibly interesting stuff that animals do and then whatnot, and I thought, wow, you know, they're paying him for this. It's a good gig. I think I might like to do that. So anyway, that was a kind of an initial stimulus, and then, I just stayed interested.
One question I ask people when they've done as much as you've done is, but at some point along the line, there were probably mentors and advice. What is your advice to a young scientist? What do you say to, you know, grad students and postdocs and so on?
Well, I guess for me, the variable that seems to make the most difference, if I look at the students and postdocs that I've worked with, is a motivation. It's everybody, by the time they're studying for a PhD and stuff, has got enough intelligence to do a good job. It's the people who just can't let go, they worry about this question, they worry about their study, they're thinking about it all the time. And I it's not something you can teach, but I think that when you get in a lab, where other people are highly motivated and other people feel like this is really important. It's really important that we find out the answer to this experiment. It's kind of contagious. So I would say, you know, get in a good lab, get around people who are good at what they do and who are enthusiastic about what they do. And in addition, similar, but in a more abstract way, is of course reading. And a lot of, I know that sounds ridiculous. You would think a PhD that you wouldn't have to tell them that. But there is wide variability in how much PhD and postdoc students read, and especially outside their own discipline. Philosophy or something that's outside their discipline. And again, I have found a reasonably high correlation in my personal experience that the really good students are always read a lot, and including outside their discipline, I should stress.
Yeah, because one of the points I do, one of the questions I raise with people, ask them, is the whole notion of the context of the science and the history of the science, because it's been my experience that because they're fast-tracked to some extent and have to succeed in universities, that quite often all they read is the PDFs of the papers that were yes. supposed to be downloaded, not even at the front of Nature or the back of Science yes. and the front of Science. So there's not much history and philosophy of science going into it. And yet if you start telling students about some of these great characters
yeah.
from history, they just lap it up. But it's just that a lot of those courses have dwindled away, it seems to me. I don't know.
That's a shame.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I don't want to sound like an old timer or whatever, but I do think it's harder now to browse, given the web way of doing things, than in the old days where you would go to the library and look through the shelves and you'd go for the book you were looking for, and then you would just take a few minutes to look around on the other shelves nearby. I know that theoretically you can do that on the web, but it just is harder somehow. And the same way with PDFs, you get the one PDF you need as opposed to looking at the whole journal and seeing what's in it and whatnot. So I think you have to make an effort. You have to make an extra effort to do that.
In terms of characters from history, if I gave you a time travel token and allowed you to bring to your dinner table anybody from any period, is there somebody you'd like to ask questions of and sit down and have a conversation with?
Oh, boy. Well, I hate to be not any more original than this, but Charles Darwin. I mean, I know that's too easy, but I've read his the recent biography by Janet Brown, the two volumes, and what a life. As a young man, he was quite ambitious scientifically and going on the trip, of course, the Voyage of the Beagle and whatnot. And then in his older age, he just was reflecting on the meaning of it all, and he just had the trajectory that I think all people in science who have some ambition want. They have it has the trajectory of producing a lot of data and adding to our store of knowledge as a young person, and then trying to reflect on what it all means as you get older. And he had the full package. I'd love to be able to talk to him.
Did you ever think of doing anything other than being a scientist? Is there anything else that you'd like to be?
Well, this is a rock star
or something.
Yeah, okay. You know, if I could play the guitar like Eric Clapton, I'd cash it all in. Why not? Yeah, sure. Yeah. No. I would. I would like to play the guitar, but no. I would. I sort of say that. I was good at school and whatever, and I just switched sides of the desk. I never found anything else that I. You're in school, right? Everybody's in school, and I did reasonably well and whatnot, and I liked it reasonably well, and nothing ever came to pull me away from it. So when you turn into an academic, you just basically switch sides of the desk. But you're still a student in some sense. You're a student of nature, to use Isaac Newton's term. You're a student of nature, and there's still nothing for me as exciting as an experiment whose result you don't know ahead of time, and then here it comes. So I can't say that I've ever had any really strong ambition to do anything else.
The conference on Darwin at the Social Sciences at Cambridge.
Yeah.
What did you talk about there?
Well, I think there's a huge confusion among people in the social sciences about evolution. And it is because a lot of them associate it with a reductionistic version of evolution in terms of DNA and genes and stuff. And of course, we know that's the driving force. But Darwin's theory of evolution, of course, which is the basics from a process point of view. It doesn't rely on that at all, of course. He knew nothing about genes or DNA. It's essentially a historical theory. The theory is, here's this group of animals, and here was the situation, and these went over here, and they all died, and these went over here, and these lived, and they lived because of were adapted for certain conditions, and so forth and so on. It's essentially historical. His original impetus for the theory, if you read The Voyage of the Beagle and these other things, is the distribution of the animals. That in South America, not only did he find species that were not in England, but there would be five or six related species that were not like they were in England. So the distribution was, this must be a common descent, five or six different species like this here. And in England, we have five or six species that they don't have over there. And he's just trying to give an account of how things came to be that way. And that should be quite compatible with the social sciences, a historical explanation. Now, we also have an evolution, an underlying reductionistic, if you will, version that involves molecular biology and whatnot, and that's of course critical, but you can understand the workings of evolution in the way that Darwin invented the concept of natural selection, just in terms of kind of a history.
I'm just intrigued by these lectures that you've given because of the names. The Liz Bates Memorial Lecture, I mean that's a rethinking innateness.
Yes.
Person.
Well,
you've got the Helmholtz lecture. Helmholtz, an absolutely classic figure in development of all of these ideas.
Yes.
Vygotsky.
Yes. Yes.
If you were speaking to these themes,
they all weave together in some sense. I mean, obviously, if you study, if you think evolutionarily, as I do. Then I don't tend to use the word innate because I think it's kind of oversimplifying. But of course, there are biological adaptations. We're adapted in certain ways to do certain things. But many of our cultural skills, this was Vygotsky's great insight, many of our cultural skills are things that have a history, a cultural history. So calculus didn't come into existence all of a sudden one day. Calculus has a history of number words and Arabic numerals and arithmetic and people building on one another. And children today, they just get calculus and they just learn it. And of course, they have biological predispositions, but nobody has a biological predisposition for calculus. They have it for some more general, and in fact, there are many cultures, of course, where calculus doesn't exist. So we're adapted for tuning in to the things that have been built up in our culture over historical time. And those are more general adaptations than a specific one for a specific behavior or something. So we're trying to find the right balance of these different factors. I mean, the way I like to think of it is that if you take some specific skill, like take my skill with language, it comes from three different time frames that operate at three different units, with three different units. So the evolution of my species, humans, gave me certain abilities that enabled this. But there's a cultural history of the people who ended up speaking English, the Germanic peoples and blah, 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 and they end up speaking English, so there's a cultural history of English. And then there's my own individual, and that's the cultural group. And then there's my own individual history as a person and the language I heard from my parents growing up and whatnot. And so these three strands, they work on different time frames, they work on different units, and all three of them contribute to our skill with things cultural. Obviously, color vision doesn't depend on cultural evolution, so it would have a phylogeny, and the ontogeny of color vision would probably be not that interesting. It's mainly phylogeny, but then there are other things like language where you're going to have all three time frames.
So when you talk about the Vygotskian intelligence hypothesis,
It's another word for the cultural intelligence hypothesis, but it's basically that again, the child on the desert island would be kind of smart enough to get around and survive, but they wouldn't be inventing calculus on their own. They wouldn't be inventing a language on their own. They're getting that for free, as it were, from the culture if they have the skills to do it. Now, we know that the skills to be able to acquire these things is a biological adaptation itself, because there are children who don't have that, who have some kind of a problem. Children with autism are the ones that come to mind. Children with autism have problems with communication, with theory of mind kinds of things. With play, with all kinds, they have a lot of these social things they have trouble with, and they don't assimilate all the skills of their culture to the same degree that other children do. So the child on the desert island has got the skills, but they don't have a culture to cultivate them, within which to cultivate them. And the child with autism is in a rich cultural environment, but they don't have the biology for it. So we need both of them.
So what's your research plan for the future at this point? I mean, what are you working on?
Yes, I guess I'm pretty much focused on collaboration, cooperation right now, and I also and communication, because communication, the way that humans do it, is another form of cooperation. I would say that we share information with people freely. When you and I are having a conversation, if you don't understand, you ask or you shake your head. So we're collaborating to get this message across, to have this conversation. Linguistic symbols themselves are shared. We can use them, because even though you and I have never used certain words together before, I know that as a speaker of English, you know these words as well as I do. So human communication is also a function of this cooperative way of life and cultural way of life.
So this fits nicely with the cognitive sciences then?
Yeah.
Last question, because I know you have to go and prepare for your lecture. What are you optimistic about?
Well, I would say that when I talk to a more general audience, I usually start with the following observation, that most people who aren't academics and who aren't evolutionists think, oh my God, people are so uncooperative. There's so much competition, there's so much nastiness, there's war, there's all of this. And why is that? Why can't we just all get along and be cooperative? But if you're an evolutionist and you see the red of, however that goes, tooth and claw, cooperation of humans is quite remarkable. The way we trust one another in our daily dealings, the way we are generous when someone needs help, the way we get things done collaboratively that no one could do on their own. And of course, there's all conflict as well. But I'm optimistic because I think the human tendency to be cooperative and collaborative will in the end, get us through it all.
Steven Pink has a new book coming out at some point in October, in which he looked at the numbers on violence and people dying in conflict and so on, and come to the surprising conclusion that although those are horrible statistics, that in fact, I think his claim is that things are getting better, and he's had some very careful analyses done and showed that point that you're making that gives people some hope of improvement.
If I can just talk at one more level of detail, is that the majority of human history was in small hunter-gatherer type groups. And there you cooperate within your group and you're generous and helpful within your group. But we also grew up to compete with other groups. So in our evolution, there's a lot of group competition. Now what happens is when agriculture comes along at 10,000 years ago, more or less, now we have people from all different groups all coming to the food, and cities have mixes of people with different and all that. And we still have a psychology that is small group psychology with a mistrust of people from other groups. So to really make it, we have to overcome this in-group, out-group psychology, our mistrust of people from other groups, which is, I would say, a reality. Even those of us who pride ourselves in being cosmopolitan and in giving respect and everything to people in other groups, we still have a certain affinity to people within our group. And we have to find a way to balance that and think of humanity as one big group.
Well, Mike Tomaselli, thanks very much. Great to see you again. And now you've got to go and prepare for the lecture, and we will come down and listen to you.
Okay, great. Thank you, Roger. Okay.